From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2014 all across New York State. An estimated 67,000 students did not take the standardized math test from grades 3 through 8, and an estimated 49,000 students did not take the English language arts test. This year, some school districts have reached out to parents not to advise them to pull their kids from the testing, but to make sure they understand how to do that if they so choose. It's a movement known as the I Refuse movement to oppose high-stakes testing. Here's how it works. Teachers who already have children in school are opting their own kids out, but teachers are instructed not to talk to other students about opting out. Instead, parents receive a sample letter that they can send to the district administration advising that their child will not take the Common Core line tests. A district in suburban Buffalo has examined a boycott, but more schools are instead choosing the I Refuse movement or some variations of it. On Monday, Churchville Chilai Education Association adopted a resolution supporting the movement following Brockport, Spencerport, Gates Chilai, and Calmum, among others locally. Some of the most vocal opposition to proposed reforms have come from Fairport, where they've held a rally, where Superintendent Bill Calla has been answering parents' questions and helping them understand the process. Again, not advising them one way or another, but simply making sure they have information if they don't want their kids to take the tests. Now, supporters have called Bill Calla a hero for his outspoken response to testing and proposed reforms. Advocates for reforms accuse Calla of inciting a bit of chaos into the system, of blocking the needed changes for students. And while thousands of students did opt out last year, it's also true that more than 1.1 million took the test, so roughly 95% of students took the tests last year. What's going to happen this year? Is it appropriate for schools to instruct parents on how to take kids out of testing if they so choose? What will the impact be if much larger numbers of kids don't take the tests? My guest for the hour, Bill Calla, is the Fairport superintendent. He's in studio. Bill, nice to see you.
Glad to be here.
John Baines, the president of the Fairport Educators Association and an English teacher. John, nice to see you.
Glad to be here.
And Teddy Uriola is a Rochester pre-K teacher. Teddy, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
1 week ago on this program, we heard from folks who certainly identify themselves in the pro-reform movement. You'll hear some of their comments this hour, and we want to hear from you if you want to join the conversation. But let me start with Bill Calla, and Bill and I were just talking before the show began. I will make clear, and I think Bill will make clear as well, nobody in this room is telling parents, you should do this. The question is it appropriate to reach out to parents to say, if you want to do this, here's how? Bill, I know there's a difference, but how do you draw the line, and what have you been doing in Fairport?
Well, in February, I sent a letter to parents that it was actually in response to what I was receiving. Okay, so parents would contact us and say, look, I'm considering opting my child out of the 3 through 8 tests. Give me some information. And that really picked up quite a bit last year and is, you know, escalated dramatically this year. So this year we had a guidance letter for administrators. This year, all of our administrators got together and said, look, we're getting too many questions, and people really need to know what their rights are and what we're going to do when children decide to refuse the tests. So I put together a one-page document which basically states, here are your rights, and here's what we're going to do if you decide to have your child refuse to take the tests.
For those who have said you are inciting, that mm-hmm. you are urging parents to do it, that is not true?
Well, if truth does that, I can't help that. We have been very open with the facts, and parents have a right to refuse the tests, and we're not going to deny that. And we also are very clear on what the ramifications are. If they do take the test, if they don't take the test, and it's their decision to make. So if providing information and accurate information is inciting, then we're inciting.
How many parents have you heard from so far?
As far as...
In terms of planning to opt out.
To refuse at this point, our letter, when we gave our letter to them in February, we asked that they, for the ELA, contact us by April 10th. So we still have almost 2 weeks left ahead of us. And for the ELA, and by April 20th for the math test. And we expect, as traditionally, that we will see most of those refusals come within that week before the test. But right now, we're at a rate that is five times what it was last year.
Five times.
Yes.
So as I said when we opened the program, roughly, by my numbers, maybe 5% of students grades 3 through 8 did not take math or English tests last year. You expect that to be much higher?
Oh, much higher, yes.
Okay. And what is the impact, Bill? I've already heard from parents who want to know, does this mean school districts could lose funding? Is there any risk associated with that?
No, that's I made that very clear in the letter. And there's a lot of intentional misinformation that is coming from a variety of sources to scare people, to scare parents into making one decision or another. And the biggest scare tactic is, well, if your school district doesn't have 95% of your kids take the test, you're going to lose funding. And that's absolutely not true. In fact, it's very explicit what the issue is that if your district falls below 95% participation rate for 3 years in a row, then your Title I funds, which are federal funds, which are very specifically earmarked, the government will not take them away, but may speak with the district on how those funds should be used, which is interesting because there's not a whole lot of latitude that you have with Title I funds anyway. Your Title I funds are to deal with children of poverty in your schools who have academic issues. So basically what they would do is come in and tell you to continue doing what you're doing because that is what the funds are used for.
But doesn't that sound like an overture that maybe they will ramp it up and say 3 years running, less than 95%? There's no reason to think that's an overture for cutting funding.
They would be breaking their own law. The law is very explicit that they will not remove the funding. The law is explicit in that they may redirect how you use the funds in your district.
We're talking to Bill Califf, Fairport Superintendent, John Baines, an English teacher and president of the Fairport Educators Association. Teddy Uriola is a Rochester pre-K teacher. And so again, you've got a superintendent and a couple of teachers. Teddy, when you hear around Rochester, obviously a very different district than Fairport, are you hearing anything about opt-out numbers, for example? I mean, are you assuming that the numbers will be much higher this year?
I have really not a lot of information on that particular number. I don't believe that our district is giving a whole lot of information about that out to parents or to the public. It's kind of kept quiet. I know that I think a year ago, the Board of Education, I believe, passed a resolution that was opposed to too much testing. I'm not sure exactly how the wording was on that, but it was not specifically tied to refusals or opting out or anything like that. I think that the numbers in the Rochester City School District last year were fairly small in the refusals.
Do you want to see your district do more to reach out to parents?
I think it would be a good idea because I think that as one of the poorest districts in New York State, if not the entire country, we're the ones that are being most adversely affected by the use of these tests. So our students who are being held accountable for things that are completely inappropriate developmentally, and then that in turn is going to affect, it's like a domino effect. And so to give parents that information so that they know what the tests are actually being used for and they know what to expect, and as Dr. Calla said, is I think really important because in the end, the more that actually refuse, and that's my bias, the better off we are as opposed to having them take the tests and fail the tests.
To add to that, which is very coincidental, that I've been contacted repeatedly by parents in other districts, including the Rochester City School District, and one parent particularly in the Rochester City Schools is begging for information and said that we're hearing nothing in Rochester and we need to know what the landscape is. And I could only give them, the facts that I know and the perspective I know, but again, I don't believe any providing accurate information is really necessary for parents to make a, you know, an advised decision.
Right. It's my understanding that last year there was not even a cohesive policy within the Rochester City School District on how to deal with the individual students who opted out or refused the test, that it varied from building to building.
Okay. In a moment, I want to try to open it up and not only hear from your phone calls, but hear from some folks who have already written into the program in advance of this panel today. Here's a headline from the wires just about an hour ago from Kenmore, New York, under the headline, "Test Boycott: New York District Moves Toward Skipping High-Stakes Tests." An upstate New York school district has moved a step closer to boycotting the state's standardized tests in April in opposition to Governor Andrew Cuomo's education policies. Kenmore Tonawanda Board of Education voted last night to, quote, seriously consider not administering the mandatory math and English tests to students in grades 3 through 8. But voting to seriously consider is not voting to do it. They're not boycotting yet. Bill, you're kind of smirking a little bit, but you don't view that as significant news then, do you?
No, I do. I do. It's, you know, but seriously consider is not doing it. I'm not faulting the resolution. I think the resolution is very powerful in that it sends a message that this particular board recognizes the problems involved with the 3 through 8 testing, and it's something that they are giving serious thought to.
Did Fairport consider it?
Fairport's discussed it. You know, Fairport. We were given this resolution by Kenton a couple of weeks ago, before they had their first meeting on it, and our Fairport board is certainly warm to it. Whether or not they do anything with it to go that far, I don't know. But our position is provide people with good, solid, accurate information so that they could make decisions. I think this is something that I believe parents really need to be active with, one way or the other. I think parents are really the key here.
Okay. But if Fairport, for example, if you're saying that there's no consequence to students at any rate, whether 50% opt out, 5%, 1%, 100%. If there's not a consequence in funding, if it doesn't impact a teacher's evaluation, and Fairport as a board and with the superintendent leading the way don't agree with it, then why not boycott it? What is the harm? You looked into it. Is there a risk in boycotting?
Yeah, there's a risk to the board and the superintendent, because we are required to administer it. The parents aren't required to have their children take it. So there's a big difference there. So yes, there is a risk involved. So I from that perspective, you have to give the Kenton board a lot of credit for even considering it, because there are consequences.
All right, let me read a comment here, and I want to ask John and our panel to respond to the protesting crowd. This comes from educationpost.org, and it's Holly Cragthorpe, who is a veteran Minneapolis public school teacher. She now lobbies the Minnesota State Legislature on education. I've seen her piece retweeted out by a lot of people in the New York State Reform Movement, Jarrell Bradford, and many others. So let me read what Holly writes about testing. Quote, "As imperfect as our tests may or may not be, without them we would have no way of knowing how our students are doing and how best to help them. No mother wants her child to be viewed as merely a test score, and parents can opt out of testing if that is the personal choice they make. However, a mother also has every right to expect access to information about how her child and her child's school are doing compared to others across the district, state, and nation. Her tax dollars help pay for that school and should afford her an objective snapshot of her child's academic development. So when it comes to testing, how should teachers navigate this situation? Should teachers discourage students from taking state exams? Is it appropriate to hand out anti-testing leaflets and flyers during the school day? As a mother of school-aged children, I say no." John, what do you think?
Well, let's take that issue apart. The first thing I would say is that partially in response to the prior question, I don't think it's appropriate for public institutions to act as if unresolved discussions are resolved. I don't think it's appropriate to say we will not administer this test because we've reached consensus when we haven't. There's a diversity of views, as the parent from, I think it's Minnesota, mm-hmm. is saying, I have a different view. We have teachers in the Fairport schools who don't totally agree with Bill Calla. We have, they're all Americans, these people, right? And they have views and they're diverse. I think we could be a year away from having a real consensus when people have the facts. So let's get to the facts. These tests were created by No Child Left Behind for really one purpose, and that's to evaluate schools. You know, there was a very admirable goal with No Child Left Behind, which was, let's find out what schools are failing in the 3-8 area. Well, unfortunately, so much has been attached to that over the years. The Common Core came along, but also the fact that the tests are administered in a certain way. For instance, in this state, and this is something when parents hear it, they're a little shocked. In this state, when we give the test, the child receives virtually no feedback. First, we give it in April. The test is never seen by anyone. It's kind of hard to use the test as a work product to develop goals, identify deficits for the child. Like, this woman wants feedback on her child's performance. The tests we give in New York State give zero feedback. In fact, the results come in late in the summer, and all of the students in New York State are put into four buckets. They're given a number. They're a 1, a 2, a 3, and a 4. So the parents will find out your child is a 1, your child is a 2, your child is a 3, your child is a 4. But no one will ever show them the instrument used. No one really understands totally how they develop, because, of course, they develop the cut score or the numbering system after the test is given. As Bill was saying, we had a meeting with parents the other night. Fairport. We're meeting with our parents in Fairport. We want to empower them. The parents are going to lead. They're the people. They're the American citizens. And it's not our role to tell them what to do, but it's also not our role to let them continue to understand these tests as something they're not. So clearly these tests are designed by New York State to evaluate schools. Now they've been designed to evaluate teachers. But they've never been and are not designed to help kids. They provide no value to students. The student's current teacher is no longer the teacher of the child when the results come back. So I think it's important that people understand that. And the lady who's writing the article from Minnesota, she wants schools evaluated. I do too. But should we be using students in this fashion to generate a questionable metric for evaluating schools? It's the question I would ask her.
There's a difference between an imperfect measure, and she, in this article, quotes that, well, however imperfect it may be, here's what I want. I want exactly what she wants. Everything that she enumerated, that's exactly what I want. Unfortunately, this is not an imperfect measure. It's an inappropriate measure. She wants an objective snapshot. This does not give us an objective snapshot by any stretch of the imagination. And I could go through what we do know about the test because, of course, as John mentioned, these things are a big, you know, classified secret. We're even forbidden to speak about them. Yet how could we expose their flaws unless we see the test? Well, the state did reveal half of the questions in this last past administration. And lo and behold, you know, what we find is just some incredible information on these tests. And just for example, this is really important stuff. I have three sample questions in front of me that were from the grade 3 test last year. And by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 readability measures, like Flesch, Kincaid, Gunning, Fogg, Coleman, Liao, SMOG, automated readability index, question number one in point, the average reading level for the third grade test is an 8.1, and the highest level being a 9.8. The second question, the highest level of, this is a third grade test, 12.5. And the average reading level for that question and that paragraph of reading comprehension is 9.8. And the third one is 8.5. So when you look at developmental appropriateness, how these were put together, nothing fits. There is no objective snapshot from this. you know, there's an, I don't know what the purpose of having reading levels for a third grader being 5 and 6 grade levels above serves any purpose.
Okay, well, but let me get back to then what she said, and even with that idea in place, she is saying her tax dollar support schools, we've got to find a way to compare schools within a district, schools from district to district, schools from state to state. If not the test, then how?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be. See, if not the test, you see, we're making it a black and white dichotomy. I don't think there's anyone here in this panel today that doesn't believe in tests. And I don't think there's anyone that doesn't believe in some sort of a standardized test. But when now you attach high stakes to them for which the tests were never intended, that's where the problem develops. There are many ways to do this. First of all, you know, testing every year and making it determining whether or not a child is going to be a 1 through 4, whether or not teachers are this is their entire evaluation. All of these pieces are really unintentional with regards to these tests. We don't have to test every year. There's a false dichotomy here that first of all, schools are failing. I mean, that's, and I heard on the program yesterday,
Ken Warner said public schools are absolutely falling apart.
Right. It was, I heard that and I cringed. Okay. Everything he said after that was accurate, but the fact of the matter is society is falling apart and that we're not addressing the causes. Now, if we look at Ed Doherty's study on poverty and on test scores from last year's test, and you look at the graphs for poverty and the graphs for the results of the tests, they overlap almost perfectly. And that has to tell you something. And that includes the Rochester City Schools. So when you disaggregate for poverty, what you have are very high-performing schools. And you can't just ignore that and say, well, that doesn't count. It does count.
Okay, but
can I go back and answer your question?
I do want to hear, how do we then measure schools?
Okay, let's get,
and throwing tests aside, what are some of the other metrics that we can use?
Let's talk about it. Yes. I think that the folks down in Buffalo have taken a stab at it. At Buffalo, what's it called? Something First or something? They have there are various algorithms that people use.
First.
What's it called?
The
Buffalo newspaper.
Yeah, Business First.
Business First. But I think you have to have enough data points to provide context. Graduation rates are important. Attendance is very important. It's a very high predictor of student performance. I think you have to look at post-high school success rates over a 4-year or 8-year period, longevity, tracking with longevity the performance of the students who attend a school district going forward. You have to have a data point around poverty. That has to be part of it. I think there has to be, we have to look at testing. I think testing is an important data point. The problem is when it's decontextualized and it's not looked at from a whole series of, you know, how much professional development is provided for the teachers in a district is another factor. So I think that as a community, New York State is a state community, we need legislation around kind of the Universal School Comparable Act, if you will, where we decide these are the measures we're going to use. Right now, we're seeding that metric to various magazines like the Magazine in Buffalo. You've got the U.S. News and World Report making up their little fantasy about what's a good school and what isn't a good school and ranking them, and that's a bizarre metric that they're using. And so certainly advanced placement exams written or IB exams written, performance on them, those are all effective tools. But we have to have a more rational discussion about how to compare schools that doesn't involve one poorly made tests by a private corporation that really has no interest in children and has 100% interest in profit.
I'm late for a break, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back, get to some of your phone calls, and dig a little bit more into some of the issues that have been coming up. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Bill Calla, Fairport Superintendent, John Baines, who is the president of the Fairport Educators Association, Teddy Uriola, who's a pre-K teacher in Rochester. And we're talking about the question of parents' choice to opt out their children or not from state testing, particularly 3 through 8. Your questions answered after this short break on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I was just saying to the panel, I've taught for, in my whole life, 2 months at Nazareth as an adjunct, and it would drive me nuts if my students could not see what they got wrong on a quiz. So to John's point about, and to what our panel's been talking about, when students take a test but can't see what they've gotten wrong, it is very difficult to learn what mistakes you might have made. Even if the test is beautifully made, a beautifully constructed test, if you can't see what you got wrong, I don't fully understand why that would be the case. Gary, in the city of Rochester. Gary, go ahead.
Oh, Evan, first of all, another excellent panel discussion. Thank you for doing this.
Sure.
And some of my questions have actually been answered. But one of the things that I've observed, or at least seemed to me, is that teaching, you know, police work and plumbing are all disciplines that everyone thinks that they can do. And that in the last, maybe especially 10 years, when you have political leaders like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, and in this case, in our case in New York, Andrew Cuomo to a certain extent, demonizing teachers and teachers' unions, that doesn't help. And it seems like with this testing, I haven't heard anything about how any of, especially like New York's teachers or teachers' unions, what input they had in this. And it seems to me that, you know, we wouldn't go, if we had a medical problem, we wouldn't ask everyone but the doctor. So why is it that we're asking and seem to be asking everyone but the teachers? Or have I just missed something? Thank you.
Gary, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Teddy.
I'm sorry. I jumped right in there. That's one of the problems with this entire reform movement is that it has been built around the notion that the schools are failing, which is a myth created by manipulated data. And then they stepped in and they have created the reform with businessmen using a business model for the reform. And really, no educators were involved with the creation of the Common Core State Standards, which sort of predicated all of this with through Race to the Top. It was created by three individuals, David Coleman, Jason Zimba, and Susan Pimentel, who really never taught a day in their lives in a classroom, business people, lobbyists. They were hired by the National Governors Association and the Chief Council of State School Officers. And so the reform movement then tells us that this is all state related and the states wanted this, when in reality those two organizations are basically lobby groups for in the Beltway. They're not state-led organizations at all. And so educators were not involved. These three individuals had their group of people were educrats, formed the standards, and then they had a group of people that they sent their standards out to, no child development specialists either or psychologists. They send the standards out to their validation committee, and the two educators that were on the validation committee, Sandra Stotsky, who was actually the head of education for Massachusetts when they had some of the best standards in the country. She's now, I believe, in Arkansas, if I'm not mistaken. And James Milgram, who was in Stanford, looked at the standards. Sandra looked at the ELA portion, and James Milgram looked at the math, and they both said that the standards were not good. And so rather than looking at what these two individuals, who were the educators being asked to validate them, said, they said, well, we're sorry, but these are the standards. If you're not going to validate them, bye-bye.
Yeah, a couple of pieces to add to that. There were 130, on the early childhood standard, there were 135 people who were on that committee, and there was not one educator or child development specialist. There were 500 experts from early childhood and education professionals that signed a statement. They wrote a statement that basically what their concerns were with the standards. That number one, the standards would lead to long hours of instruction in literacy and math. Very prophetic. That's exactly what's happened. I've seen schedules that's all around elementary schools is math and literacy, and everything else has been excised. It will lead to inappropriate standardized testing. We know that's happened. Didactic instruction and testing will crowd out other important areas of learning. And there's little evidence that such standards for young children lead to later success. None of this has been evidence-based.
And, in fact, the teachers in New York went in the room in the form of the president of the New York State United Teachers and agreed to this APPR deal, the original one that was put together. The person who went in the room's name was Dick Iannuzzi. He, the first time in the history of the New York State United Teachers, was quite quickly deposed after that, after he went in and made that deal validating these tests as the instrument to evaluate teachers. That was one of the driving reasons why he was eliminated by a coup within NYSET in this most recent election last year.
And you also have to look at the money that's been involved in it. The reason why the New York State United Teachers and the American Federation of Teachers and even the PTA, who you would expect to be standing up for the rights of parents and children, all of them have received millions upon millions of dollars from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to push and support the standards which are driving the tests.
But let me ask you a quick question, and I ask because I'm just curious about this. Bill Gates is a big figure behind Common Core. When you look at the interviews with him, I'm trying to figure out, nobody can get inside somebody's head. Why do you think he's doing this, Teddy?
Well, I think there's money to be made in
billions of dollars. He has a lot of money, doesn't he?
He does, but I'm sorry, but no one has enough money, especially when you get at those levels. And I think that I learned a lot a couple weeks ago from Dr. Calla when he spoke about, I never quite understood it, why people were investing in charter schools. And it really suddenly clicked that, you have these aha moments. They want, the tests are created so that the children will fail. They will fail, so then the teachers will fail. It's the dominoes. And when the teachers and the children fail, the schools will fail. And so one of the tenets of Race to the Top is that failing schools will be turned around. And how are they turned around? Their charter schools are created. And so why is that such a big deal? It's a school. It's the same kids. It's whatever. But the money then is to be made in the creation of these charter schools. There is a law in the books that allows people to invest in charter schools and get a 37% or 39% tax credit. That's sure money. That's not an investment. That's not risk. That's sure money. It's a tax credit on their investment. So they get that money. Within 7 years, they've more than doubled their investment on this money that they put into charter schools. They can't do it and put the money into public schools. It's charter schools. So it's all a money-making proposition to privatize education. So the purpose of the tests, people need to remember, the purpose of the test is to fail the students, fail the teachers, turn the school around, and create a charter school. And then that money goes back into the politicians' pockets in the form of campaign contributions, which is why you see Cuomo pushing to raise the cap on charter schools. And not just Cuomo, but Scott Walker and across the political spectrum.
Just because, again, a week ago we had sort of the more of the pro-reform crowd in, including Justin Quassa, who's with the Charter Schools Network, and he had some comments about charter schools. Yes, he agreed that the premise of charter schools is to study what can work in a little bit more of a throw-the-shackles-off environment and then apply it back to public school. And what I want to do is I want to listen to Justin Quassa's bite, if we could. So, unfortunately, I see the phones are ringing and our poor engineer John is buried back there. But just in just a second, John, I'd love to hear what Justin Quassa had to say.
Bill Gates is probably doing this for the right reasons. I think he probably wants to help. Robert Moses was trying to help everybody when he was building those highways right through the middle of New York City. And that's the classic problem with a reformer. When a reformer is so far removed from the reality of the thing he's reforming, Robert Moses never operated a car, and yet if you read The Power Broker, the great Robert Caro book about New York politics, he was the dominant figure telling everybody how they should live. And you have a situation where you have the ultimate oligarch in the case of this man, telling everybody how our communities, how our schools should run, et cetera. I think he's doing it because he thinks he's helping.
Well, and Bill Gates is also someone whose children, just like John King, the prior commissioner, his children do not attend schools that implement the Common Core or any of the testing. Bill Gates himself never went to those kind of schools. In fact, it's my understanding Bill Gates didn't finish school. Wow. So how are you
He's
pushing
this? He's a Harvard dropout.
Yeah.
He did all right.
I don't know if our poor engineer is getting an earful, John, but you can let them go because I need – let's listen to what Justin Kwasa. It's the third bite. And, again, we're talking charter schools. And Justin was asked about the question of not only – some of the concerns that Teddy's raised, but also the comment that charter schools sort of stack the deck by sort of allocating the top students, et cetera. Here's Justin Kwasa defending charter schools.
Well, the one thing I will say about charter schools is charter schools would not exist unless there was a want for another option. For as long as we can remember, there's always been the Rochester City School District. And at some point, the parents and members of the community said, we need something different. So you said, you know, people always want to say that charter schools siphon off or they only take the best. Those students were originally in the Rochester City School Districts, and it wasn't working for them. So we also need to determine why wasn't it working for them in the Rochester City School Districts. And then they came up to the charters where all of a sudden, yes, all of a sudden now results are being gotten. So I think that's a question we also need to ask when we have the charter school debate.
The issue is concentrated poverty. People want their kids out of an environment of concentrated poverty and everything that goes along with that. But let's talk about, he really did not address the issue of how charter schools cream kids or how they throw kids out or the contracts that they sign with parents that if they don't follow rule A, B, and C, your child is out. How they don't take English language learners to in some at all.
He might say that those rules to throw kids out establish discipline and higher
Lovely.
Standards.
Lovely. You can't do that in a public school, so how could you compare apples to oranges?
Mike,
you know,
yeah.
If we could do that, first of all, I wouldn't do that because we need to educate every child. I think that's ridiculous to think that it's a good thing to take kids in and then create rules that the public schools we'd be up on charges if we did that.
Especially
in
if the premise is take a look at what a charter school can do and then apply that more broadly to the districts,
yes.
Which he did say.
You can't do that. So you can't take what charters are doing. You can't take that because it's mutated. The purpose of charters has mutated. It was supposed to be a think tank where you're to come up with ideas that you can't apply to a regular public school, but you can't apply these rules because they're discriminatory. The discipline is discriminatory. The fact that you don't take ELLs is discriminatory. The fact that you don't take special education students is discriminatory. The fact that you have parental contracts is discriminatory. Every charter that opens up in the city of Rochester puts another nail in the coffin of the regular public school.
All right. And one of the things I learned the other day was that the charter schools not only siphon off the per pupil expenditure of the students who leave the district and go into the charter school, but if they do take students who have special education needs or are ELL students, the home district is also
Correct.
Responsible
yeah.
for paying the teachers to go out as itinerant teachers and go into those schools and service those students within the charter system. A lot of the students who are siphoned out because of discipline and behavior. They come back into the city schools or into the school district, the home district. And as a classroom teacher, as a teacher and not a pre-K teacher because it doesn't necessarily reflect on what I do, but as a teacher in the public school system, if I have to make blueberry muffins, I love this analogy, if I have to make blueberry muffins, and so if you come and drop off a load of blueberries for me, and I'm going to make my prize-winning blueberry muffins, and you give me a bunch of cruddy blueberries. As a business person, I send all those blueberries back, and I go, I can't make my prize-winning blueberries. That's what the charter schools do. I'm in the public school, so you drop off those crummy the blueberries, and no matter what you've given me, I've got to do something with those blueberries. So maybe I'm going to make blueberry jam instead of blueberry muffins today. But I have to do something. I don't have the option and of saying, no, I'm not going to teach you.
All right. On the issue of poverty, that panel, which included Justin Kwasa, also included a couple of people who have worked on various panels on reform committees. Carrie Remus is a parent. She's a member of several panels that have focused on education. The governor, one of the governor's panel last year, she was a part of Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren's panel that looked at education. And they agreed that, yes, poverty is an issue. But she said we shouldn't discount the impact of teachers. She disagrees with the idea that a teacher accounts for between 10 and 20% of an educational outcome.
You could disagree with that all you want. This is based in research.
All right, well, let's listen first to some of what Carrie Remus had to say about that.
Of all the school-based factors, effective teaching matters most. What he hasn't said about the research is that we know now that the poor children are more likely to have an ineffective teacher, more likely to have an unqualified teacher, more likely to have an inexperienced teacher. So we have to develop policy tools to get at that problem, that double standard.
There's two issues there. Okay, the first issue is 10 to 20% of the impact as a teacher. That's actually a massive, massive impact. All right, that is a huge impact. And I think that when teachers' unions and teachers make two arguments, they say, we're important, and then they turn around and say, we can't control anything, they're really being self-defeating. The reality is that the teacher is a significant variable, but the critical variable is the child and the family. And this is something people don't want to say because it doesn't fit into the super leader narrative. Michelle Reed doesn't fit into her narrative that she is going to wear the cape and save us all. It doesn't fit into the Teach for America narrative. It doesn't fit into the leaders who say it's all about us. We have the answers. So I think that that's part of it. The second part of what she's saying is real. Yeah, she's saying something that's very real, and that is, and this is something that I think Adam Urbanski and other people in the city have worked hard at, and that is that it's difficult to keep the more experienced teacher in an extremely, extremely intense environment for 35 years. And so you're in an environment with the neediest children who are putting tremendous demands on you psychically and emotionally. And people move. And I think the city of Rochester and other urban districts, and I think, quite frankly, our district should. I have a philosophy that I'm one of the highest paid teachers in Fairport. I should be working with the neediest population because I should be working. You know, I'm more experienced. I have a greater repertoire. So I think that there's something quite a bit to her second point that we have to look at our systems so that we try to put in the classroom with the neediest child the most qualified teacher. And I think that's something that we need to talk about and we should talk about and we have been talking about.
Now, I think this will probably surprise Carrie, but I agreed with everything she had to say. And there was nothing that I said prior to that that really discounted that. The fact of the matter is, however, is that we're someone has a cold and we're putting a tourniquet on the person. We're using the wrong tools to get to those issues. Those are issues. Teachers are the strongest in-school factor. And as John said, it's large as an in-school factor, but you can't ignore the other 80%, which is huge. We need to be addressing that 80%, and we can't be putting tourniquets on people who have a cold.
Okay, well, then there's one other comment. Let's get to this, because if we agree then on some of those points, we also hit another point, which is the question of tenure and rooting out teachers who are not effective teachers. And last time you were on this program, Bill, you made the point that people don't realize how effective districts can be at looking at teachers and saying, you're not going to get tenure. We're going to counsel you out. The teachers who end up with tenure are carefully evaluated along the way, mm-hmm. is part of the point you were making.
Correct.
And the ones who are not effective are essentially counseled out.
Right.
Carrie had some comments about what happens in that scenario. Let's listen.
You know, this counseling out practice, that, and you hear this a lot from suburban mm-hmm. superintendents, mm-hmm. these people that are counseled out, they go someplace else to teach. They go to poor districts to teach. They're not leaving the profession necessarily.
All right, so when Bill Kell is saying they're very good at identifying teachers who shouldn't get tenure,
That doesn't mean they're leaving the practice
entirely.
That's
right. It means they're not in the affluent suburbs.
But Bill Callum may say other districts that he's not only speaking for Fairport, that districts do a good job generally of sussing out who is going to be effective or not before anybody gets tenure in Fairport or anywhere else.
I don't believe there's any data that supports that. The unsuccessful teachers in the affluent suburbs get counseled out and get sent to the city.
This sent to the city, I mean, that is really, that's a really a fantasy. What is it? Is there a bus where they get shipped up to the city and then they throw them to work? I mean, I think that's a kind of an outrageous way of characterizing the Rochester City School District Human Relations Department, all the principals there, et cetera. But part of what's going on in this country is we have a teacher shortage. We have a shortage of prepared teachers, even with declining enrollment. And one of the reasons is that teachers have been villainized. They're under attack. The job is very, very difficult, particularly when you start out. You're making $36,000, $37,000 a year, incredible pressure on you. And so as a result, we have people who don't make it. Sometimes people make it in another environment. You know, they might have a skill set that works in another district. But if she's claiming that there's no evidence that everybody isn't leaving the suburbs, being culled out, and then becoming city school teachers, that's an outrageous insult.
I don't
want to
speak for her.
Well, I heard what she said, me speak. No. She's saying that they're all in the city school district, and I think that's an incredible insult to the teachers of the city school district.
But
it's just wrong.
All right, but hold on one second, because, John, she may say, you just acknowledge that it is stressful for any teacher in a district that has a concentration of poverty, that is difficult, and that sometimes those teachers leave. They've got to be replaced by somebody, and she may say that's who they're being replaced by, the people who are not getting tenure in more affluent districts.
It's possible that there's a small minority of it, but once you've failed in this profession, it is not. People don't sign up to fail twice. I'll tell you, once you get your self handed to you on a platter, in this profession. And you know what? People who are successful have it happen. You go home. There are days when you go home a failure. You go home a failure because you lost your job. There aren't too many people. And so I don't understand what she's talking about.
Yeah. And as a teacher in the Rochester City School District, some of the best teachers that I have ever seen are in the Rochester City School District. Like you said, dealing with the children that we get, we make a choice. I made a choice when I moved to Rochester that I wanted to apply to the Rochester City School District and teach there. I taught in the Fort Worth City School Independent School District. I've taught in the Republic of Panama in an international school where I had the children for the high command of Noriega in my school. I've taught the heads of multinational corporations in Fort Worth. I taught illegal immigrants.
All right.
I've seen a lot, and I wanted to come to Rochester and teach there. I didn't apply in the suburbs.
Let me get a phone call. This is Bonnie. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, well, I think all the things have been talked about today, and there's some obviously understandable tension. It's just too bad some of these dialogues could be expanded and some conclusions reached based on these in more in-depth dialogues, which isn't just one discussion. That's one point. The other point is that I think, especially with the city school district and the students, I think parents are in this kind of really tough position that on the one hand, they may think, well, maybe my kids should be taking these tests because it does this or that. On the other hand, often when those kids take the test, they're the ones that are kind of, look at you, you have low scores. And that's a really bad feeling and puts people in a really, which represents a lot of the racism that isn't dealt with. The other thing, and I said this the other day, Evan, in the conversation with, I forget the young man's name that you were just referring to, it was on your program, you know, people really do not fully understand the privatization issue. And the response that that young man gave the other day was, I think he was being kind of a joke. He said, well, I haven't seen a corporate person come in my classroom and take it over. I mean, if that's really his knowledge base of what happened, this stuff is multiple layered. It's got to be talked about, and it speaks directly to some of the comments that were made in this conversation about why does a teacher in X environment, urban, city, school district type thing, have a different set of rules or things they can and cannot do than the charter school? That should be a real upfront discussion. And
I'm going to lose you because we're going to run out of time. Let me let the panel respond. Go ahead, John.
I'm not sure how to respond. I think her point that this is complex. Yeah, it'll take a lot of shows, a lot of discussion. We haven't talked about 97% of what's going on out there, and this is something that we had a forum the other day in our school district. Our PTA ran it. Bill and I were there. We took questions for 2 hours, and it was amazing how much the parents said, "Wow, I'm learning so much about the complexity of it." And here's the thing that we in the public sector forget. We think the parents are aware of everything that's going on. They're so busy. The modern family is crazy busy. The parents are crazy busy. They trust us with their kids. This is one of the reasons why I'm proud of Bill, and I'm proud of other districts that say, let's make sure parents have the facts so they are empowered to make decisions.
Okay, and Bill, I got about 20 seconds. Is this the most engaged you have seen parents, though, in your career, in the suburban district?
That's a tough one to answer because in my career, I have always reached out to make sure that parents are engaged. Mm-hmm. So they are very engaged right now.
Well, again, if you missed earlier this hour, Bill Calla described the process of parents understanding how to opt out. It's not crossing a line. It's not inciting, he says. It's not about telling them what to do. It's about giving information. That's going to continue in Fairport. We see it in Churchville, Chilai, in Brighton, in Kalamum, and many other districts that are adopting this I Refuse movement, and we'll see what the numbers are this year. About 5% opted out last year. We will see what happens this year. Bill Calla, nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
John Baines, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Teddy Uriola, thank you.
Thank you.
John Andrus, great job. Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you Thursday on Connections.